Brent joined the Association of Maternal and Child Health Programs, which is AMCHP, in 2007 as the Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs. Prior to that, he worked at Grantmakers in Health, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and InterHealth, a national association for not-for-profit, religiously affiliated hospitals and health systems. He holds a master's degree in health policy from Johns Hopkins University, and his proudest achievement is two beautiful daughters, Lucia and Cecilia, 3 and 10 months, so very little, with his wife, Samantha. Oops. Welcome, Brent.
Outdated bio, they're now 6 and 4. Time flies.
Yeah, whoops.
Thank you, yeah. So, first tragic mistake, I have no pictures of cute babies. So thank you for setting up my boring slides. and thank you all for coming. And our research in here now, we had 2, then 4. We need 8 people to come in at once, and that'll be so cool. Yeah, and my disclosures, I have no financial relationships to disclose. I am married, if that counts as a relationship disclosure. So we'll get started. But before you mentioned, here's a lead-in story that a pregnant woman, a force to be reckoned with. So, and you know, I have the 6-year-old, 4-year-old, and as you can probably tell, started a little later in life being a father, but reminds me when we were going to the hospital, and it was our first baby was breech, so it was a scheduled C-section, and so you know we were organized, calm, ready to go. But when we were coming, a younger couple was coming in at the same time. And so the pregnant woman is a force to be reckoned with, the woman in active labor even more of a force. And so they're coming by, and all of a sudden she just screams out, "Don't, can't, won't, couldn't, shouldn't, wouldn't." And I look at the dad, and he looks at me with this, you know, tear, and I can see in his head, he's thinking like, oh my gosh, that's a terrible mistake or something. But then he looks at the doctor, he says, "Doctor, what's going on?" And the doctor says, "It's okay. She's just going through contractions. Don't, can't." Yeah, apostrophe. Thank you. Who hears from out of town? So, what we're going to talk about are the policy and finance. And so I'm really going to focus on policy advocacy. And basically, the point of my talk is just sharing some lessons learned from my experience as the Director of Government Relations for AMCHIP. For those of you that don't know AMCHIP, it's the national organization that represents all the state Title V maternal and child health program directors and staff and state health agencies. So quick overview, we'll go with the traffic metaphor, we'll explain that, and then basically I'm going to be talking about two main priority programs that we work on, specifically the Title V MCH Block Grant and the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program. Just quick show of hands, are some of you, besides Dr. Kogan and Ashley, familiar with those two, or someone? Okay, good. So what is with the traffic metaphor? And I tried to be a little bit provocative. I thought some people would go, why would you possibly want to wheel a baby carriage into traffic? You would want to keep them. And I'm assuming some of you might, does anybody know this quote from Grace Abbott? So she was the second chief of the Children's Bureau back, it must have been the 30s, I'm guessing, 20s or 30s perhaps. And so just to kind of paraphrase, I can tell you when she, and it doesn't show up very good, that's a poor slide. But essentially said, sometimes when I get home at night, I feel as though I've been in a great traffic jam, and the jam is moving towards Capitol Hill, where Congress sits in judgment of the administrative agencies of government. In that traffic jam, there's all kinds of vehicles. There's the Department of Agriculture, and so this is kind of the metaphor part, the hay wagons, the Army. At one point I saw this where it said the Department of Commerce has their limousines of, you know, the business titans, and they're all heading up to Capitol Hill, and she says, as I stand on the sidewalk watching, it becomes more and more congested and more difficult, and then because the responsibility is mine and I must, I take a very firm hold on the handles of the baby carriage and I wheel it into traffic. And so clearly talking about kind of this obligation to do advocacy as an MCH professional, and if you're probably familiar, it's one of the core competencies of maternal and child health is advocacy. And we can talk a little bit, obviously in this day and age, advocacy needs to be done carefully. Probably a good time to say with that disclosure, you know, every organization has rules on what you can and cannot do, certainly cannot do any advocacy with federal dollars, and so that's something that's really important to respect. But I think what she was trying to say is it is an obligation for us as professionals to do this. And I think what she was saying was this, you know, clearly this concept of we're going into a very crowded field. There's a lot of noise that we need to break through to make sure that the needs of moms and kids and families is heard. So that's clearly, you know, at that time was the point of the metaphor is we have to break through that. Now I think the metaphor is expanded because there's you know, modern traffic, even more gridlock. I think one thing that Grace Abbott probably wasn't referring to is the gridlock that exists itself on Capitol Hill right now. She was talking about getting our message through to get into moving legislation. I think everybody's pretty aware right now that with the deep divisiveness in Congress, not only do you have the actual gridlock of traffic around Capitol Hill, you have gridlock on Capitol Hill where a lot of legislation isn't moving. Congressional productivity, I think everybody, you know, has heard, seen these headlines. The most recent Congress, one of the least productive in terms of bills passed into law. Of those bills that were passed into law, a lot of them, naming post office is another thing, so not a whole lot of productivity. That's reflected in their popularity. You can see at this time, I think this was October of 2011, so it's a little bit dated, 9%. This is fun because it's just slightly above of Fidel Castro, but notice Congress is less popular than communism. Less popular than Paris Hilton, less popular than lawyers, and although that's connected, certainly less popular than the IRS. So the reason sharing this, just kind of setting the stage, what with the environment we're trying to advocate for is very difficult right now, and getting to kind of this idea of the case study. So one of the things that we've seen over this time period is not a dramatic drop, but basically a slow erosion of funding in the Title V MCH block grant. That's one of the top priorities for my organization. I do try to point out, I came, I think, 2007, so it was dropping precipitously. We sort of flattened the curve. We were getting some small across-the-board cuts, and then the deep drop there, that represented sequestration. And so that was a cut to all federal programs, essentially. And the slightly good news is we did bounce back, partly by saying, that because of the erosion we had suffered prior to sequestration on top of that, we did get some traction by saying, you know, if we're restoring programs, we should be restored at a slightly higher level than others. And so where we go from here is really hard to predict, and we can talk about that, but that's kind of the framework. And this is just an image to show it's gotten so bad, even the statues are crying in D.C. right now. That's how tough the environment is. So with that kind of landscape and setup, the kind of key question I wanted to address is how do we approach advocacy in that crowded, acrimonious, gridlocked environment? And I won't spend a whole lot of time, and I'm glad most hands went up. I was going to do just a little background, but it sounds like many of you know the MCH Block Grant, and that's kind of a quick summary. The last bullet should be easy. That's when I took this job at AmCHIP, and they said, wait, you're advocating for moms and kids, and that moms and kids are in the name of your program? Could it be any easier than that? I mean, you know, apple pie. This is American. You know, it's should be the easiest job in the world. And everybody thinks, you know, politicians love babies. This you know, probably don't even have to show up and you win. And what I found, and I knew this taking a job, is the nuance of the program, it being a block grant, in an era where the Congress has a high degree of interest in accountability. And in programs and block grants sometimes are perceived, it's not actually, but perceived to be less accountable than some of the categorical funds. It's been a really tough job, and you can see kind of the result of that has been that erosion. So not as easy as possible. The home visiting program, that I'm going to just kind of talk about some lessons learned. Again, this is you know, a good case study. There had been a lot of home visiting happening prior to the Affordable Care Act, probably for decades, if not a century, with public health nurses riding the circuit in rural areas 100 years ago on horseback to get out to new moms and families in far-flung areas. But it was really a patchwork quilt of funding. Some states were investing significantly, others not much at all. So in the Affordable Care Act, we were really pleased that they added a new section to the Title V statute, kind of parallel to the MCH Block Grant, created the program, really set some high standards for accountability and quality and workforce, and it put in $1.5 billion over 5 years, and that we kind of were thinking was dancing in the streets investment in maternal child health. It was probably one of the biggest new investments in MCH funding that we think we'll see, at least in our near term. And then it was a 5-year authorization, which was set to expire last September. So this is kind of the case study part, that it used to be sort of a routine thing. Hello, new attendee. Welcome. Glad to see you. It used to be sort of a routine thing that when Congress created a program, usually on an every 5-year basis, they would come in and review it. They'd sometimes make changes, but it was sort of routine for them to reauthorize programs. Even that in this environment is not a given anymore. This idea of really providing a lot of scrutiny, deciding which programs will continue, and they haven't actually stopped any yet, but there's been a lot of threats to hold up programs, to reduce funding. And so where we're at right now in the life cycle of this program is the five-year authorization was set to expire last September. Last March, Congress included a provision in a much bigger package, the Doc Fix bill. They included a provision that it extended it, but just for 6 months. And so this is a new environment where usually in the old days you could count on if Congress acted, they would give you another five-year period. And now we're in a six-month period. We have to come back to Congress this spring and try to get it extended. The writing on the wall is we might only get it for another year. It makes it really hard for folks like you on the front lines to plan for programs when you don't have that certainty of budget. But again, that's sort of the landscape. Just a little more on, I think we covered what the purpose of the program is. So kind of turning to the heart of the presentation, what works? How do we get our message through that crowded and gridlocked traffic? And so just going to basically share a few observations from our work, what's worked for us, and certainly want to hear from you during the discussion if this resonates, if you have other ideas. We certainly don't have all the answers, and as you've seen, we don't have all the success, but here's the kind of things that we think have done to both stop that erosion and to help support the MCH, the home visiting program. And the first is champions. Every program needs somebody in the room when the deal is made to say, this is a program I care about, we're not going to let it expire, we're not going to cut the funding, and you want them to be the people that ideally are on the committees that make decisions. And it's a little easier said than done, because like I said, who wouldn't be for moms and kids? But the fact of the matter is, today we have so many different programs, whether it's WIC or Title X Family Planning, MCH, Home Visiting, and a lot of members of Congress want to preserve some of their pull, and so they'll pick one or two programs, but they won't necessarily be a champion for all of them. Or they'll champion one program for a couple of years until they feel like it has good grounding, and then they'll move on, maybe even outside of health, and say, now I'm going to focus on education as my top priority. And so it's sort of a constant challenge to make sure you have visible and vocal champions. And when I started, somebody said to you, who are the champions, particularly for the MCH Block Grant? And I kind of quipped that I wasn't trying to be funny, but the reality was they're all retired or dead. And it was people that, 20 years ago in Congress had really supported the program and they've moved on. So it's one of these constant, as people retire, you really need to make sure that you're looking down the road and making sure you have a bench of people that will be on those key committees of jurisdiction. So that's the second piece. 535 members of Congress, 100 senators, 400 and some House members, they're all important, they're all elected, they're all public officials, but in the parlance of Animal Farm, some animals are more important. All pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others, I think. And I didn't mean to refer to members of Congress as pigs, sorry, that was a bad metaphor. Although there is pork barrel spending, so maybe it's not. But the point being that you really need to focus and know, and I think this is usually obvious, which committees handle health policy or, in this case, appropriations policy. And there's usually a split where there's an authorizing committee that creates the program and then the funding committee. And in states and in state legislatures, they might be called different things, but in the federal government, appropriations committees. So really focusing on knowing who are those members that are on the committee that are likely to be senior enough to be in the room when the bill is being discussed and negotiated. And written, and so that's another key part. One of the key factors we found is this is a relationships business. If you're just going to those policymakers once a year, doing an annual meeting, checking it off the box, that's important, but you really need to see that meeting as the beginning of a relationship, and it's one of these things where if they just see you once a year, that's probably not going to be enough. You need to keep visible in front of them, but at the same time not annoying. They have so many people lobbying them constantly. During the key appropriation season in the spring, we ask staffers when we meet with them, what number meeting of the day are we? And many of them will have 10, sometimes 12 meetings a day, 5 days a week with constituents who are all asking for funding for different programs. So you really need to know where you are in that and know that at the end of the day, they're going to have a pile on their desk of 10 different folders that people have given them at the end of the week, close to maybe 50. And one of them said once that, they'll take all of your information, and at the end of the week, if nobody's asked them about it, they put the garbage can there and they just put it in. So it's breaking through that kind of information overload with these staffers is tough, and if you're just doing it once a year, it probably doesn't get through. But if you then establish that relationship and are able to follow up sometimes with things in the media, a quick email, or even sending them and say, hey, I don't know if you saw this article about the infant mortality rate in our state, but I wanted to make sure you knew about it. That's the sort of thing that establishes you as a trusted and a credible source of information that can help them do their job. So that's the relationships piece. The coalitions, that's another critical piece, and one of the things I learned early on in this job is every organization cares about maternal and child health, but they all have their own priorities. And so, for an example, the Academy of Pediatrics, you would think would care about all these things, but often their top priorities will be first and foremost, obviously, physician reimbursement, the healthcare insurance programs, how much they're paying docs. Secondly, but they're always good on public health, but sometimes they'll focus on immunization, sometimes they'll focus on lead, sometimes they'll focus on autism. And so sharing your priorities with your partners and making sure that they're at least in the mix is important. And knowing that your coalition partners might always not have your priority as their top priority, but when you're threatened, one of the things we found in one of the stories I wanted to tell was when the Republicans took control of the House in 2011, their very first bill that they wrote to set funding levels was proposing a $210 million cut to the MCH block grant, and you saw it's $640 million at the time. So essentially about a third of the funding was proposed to be cut. And so we certainly activated our network, but we knew that our voice alone, one organization, probably wasn't going to get their attention. And so this was a case where we went to all of our coalition partners, whether it was Academy of Pediatrics, American Public Health Association, hospitals, children's hospitals, every group that we knew cared about MCH. And when they saw that our back was against the wall and that we weren't just introducing them ourselves to them, that they knew we had been trusted partners, they all sprang into action. And so we were able to extend our reach, where our database of people that we reach when we do an action alert at the time was about 15,000. When we added in all those other groups, including the WIC directors and the Title X family planning, we estimated we reached about 160,000 health professionals. And so it's that idea of every organization has to do what they can, but the power of a coalition can exponentially expand your reach and visibility and voice. Another key thing in advocacy that I learned, and I had a boss that taught me this, is you know, sometimes those of us in public health, and maybe particularly maternal and child health, can be perceived as whiny and complaining and always focusing on here's the need, here's what's going wrong, here's what's terrible, and here's what's tragic. And that humans are more programmed to listen to you if you start with the positive. And so the story was I had written a letter to HHS. You might appreciate this. The federal government did something we didn't like at the time when I was working for the state health officials. And I wrote a letter, and it was, you know, dear Secretary so-and-so, we can't believe that you just issued this guidance, blah, 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 blah. And I took it to him, and he said, no. He said, if I got this letter as a federal official, I probably wouldn't read past the first paragraph because it's a... And he said, let's start with thank you so much for all your work to get out this very important regulation that really reflects very thoughtful, and here's what we hate about it. And he said, so if you start with the positive, you can at least get them to listen. So one of the things we've tried to incorporate when we go to the Hill in our advocacy is really starting with a positive story, and that being that in an era where people are cynical about government and concerned about fraud and waste and abuse, to really say that the federal investment in maternal and child health, starting with the beginning of the Title V MCH block grant, has literally saved hundreds of thousands of lives and a lower infant mortality rate. And so when you look over the course of progress that we've made, sometimes faster than others, but it's really dramatically reduced the infant mortality rate over 90% in the last in the lifetime of this program. And obviously we can't take all the credit for that in maternal and child health. There's certainly Medicaid coming in the 60s, you can see. There's certainly contributions that WIC and family planning and many other programs make. But if we don't take some credit, if you don't have your program taking some of that credit legitimately, you're going to miss out. So that's one we've always tried to accelerate. We do know some things that work. We've proven it, and we need additional investment to accelerate that progress. But then you do need to define the problem, and that this is kind of another, just kind of some of the practical tips is, if you're not defining the problem, you can't propose a solution. And so saying, here's what we're trying to fix, and here's what we think and know works. So giving staffers and members of Congress that idea that we have a solution that needs that investment. That idea, and this is just kind of more on the practical side, keeping your message brief and straight to the point. A lot of times people are intimidated when they're advocating, and it's easy to kind of engage in small talk and to get unfocused from the details of why you're there. So I think people appreciate it when you start by saying, here's what we're here and here's what we're asking for. And then, as I said and alluded to this, you know, keeping your materials brief. There's a kind of an unwritten rule that staffers, and particularly the policymakers themselves, don't look at anything that's more than a page. You know, on some occasions they do, but really that idea of having your key messages in a one pager and in bulleted format is just, I can't stress how important that is. And I've seen people that go in with thick reports or with even binders of material. And like I said, what happens is the staffers, they don't have the time between all those meetings to really delve into it. What you're ideally trying to do is giving them short, brief information that makes them want to learn more during some of those congressional recess period times when they have more time to sit and to delve in and think. We're really trying to get your message through with those brief pieces. And then the last piece is just, again, making sure that ask is crystal clear. And there was a story a former colleague of mine tells of she was working for Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania at the time. And some CEO from a company came in, and they sat down and they started talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and football, and they had a great conversation about, you know, the weather back in Philadelphia. And all of a sudden, the bell went off, and the senator said, "I'm sorry, but I have to go vote." And this is still, you know, 10 or 15 minutes in, and he walks out of the room, and she looked at, and the CEO looked at the staffer and said, "I never got to ask him why we were there." And she said, "No, you missed the ask." And so that's why it's so important. Get that ask at the beginning of the meeting, at the beginning of the piece. Say, "We are asking," and be specific. So when we go and we say, "We're here to talk to you about the Title V MCH block grant, we're asking for $640 million in the next appropriations bill," make it crystal clear. And like I said, it's easy to kind of get engaged in the small talk, but if they don't know what you're asking for, it's hard for them to know how to help you. Probably self-evident. But credibility is so important on the Hill. If you're not addressing what your critics are saying, if you're not focused on and you know, giving them solid information, they'll catch on to that pretty quick. And again, it's one of these, get their interest and offer to follow up with additional information when you can. Some mistakes and how to avoid them. Too often in public health, I think you know we're trained in epidemiology as the fundamental science, and so often we think the data will speak for itself, that the data will inspire action. And that's just not the case. Am I just about up? Close to it? Okay. And I think, you know, the examples here are abundant. The childhood obesity epidemic, the injury being the leading cause of death, and yet it's probably funded about 10 times less than chronic disease at CDC. There's so many examples where the data is crystal clear, but the investments and the policy don't follow because it hasn't been packaged in a way that makes it appealing to policymakers. Throwing partners under the bus in this environment, the reality is we are truly in a zero-sum game where if they want to increase the investment in one program, the money almost always has to come from another program. So sometimes staffers will try to put you in a trap and say, "We'd like to help you. Where do you think that money could come from?" And I can guarantee if you say it should come from Program X, the next time Program X lobbyist comes in, they say, you know who's targeting your money, and then you're now fighting with yourselves. And some of them do it on purpose in a way to really divide and divide and conquer the public health community. And so it's not the ideal answer, but whenever someone's asked us that question of where should the money come from, our response is, we know that that's a tough question. We know that you're elected to make those tough decisions, and avoiding that trap of saying Program X, Y, and Z, because you can guarantee if you're targeting other programs, then they'll target you and the divide and conquer. Very in the ask, again, that story that I told, if you don't get a chance to say up front, the meeting could end without them having a clear sense of what you're asking for. And then the last piece, just remembering that this is all about politics, and it's about elected officials who are looking for re-election. They want to get voted in. So they want to do the right thing, but they also want to do the thing that gets them votes. So thinking more politically, that the data won't speak for itself unless we package it in human terms, what this means for your community, for families in your district, in your state, and kind of appealing more on the politics of issues, and not in a bad way, but less so on just thinking that the data is going to work. So wrapping up, I think, you know, as I put those slides up about how bad things are in Washington, the crime statutes, you know, it's very easy to get cynical and dejected. And I think that's just a kind of a parting thought is to don't fall into that. I used the joke once that at our organization we don't hire cynics, we contract out for that. And then I realized some of our contractors were in the audience, so I felt bad about that. I apologize to them. But that idea of guarding against cynicism. And the way I do that, been in Washington for 20 years and I've seen the pendulum swing back and forth and Clinton health reform fail, the Obama health reform succeed, but clearly in an acrimonious way. And what's kept me going is a story I heard from a former CDC director, Bill Foege, many years ago, and he said that in the Middle Ages, the royal families and the merchants and the people that had power would combine forces and say, let's build these cathedrals, the great cathedrals of Europe, and they would commission the greatest craftsmen and artisans and workers to begin this. And at that time, with the technology, these craftsmen would start rebuilding the stonemasons, and they knew it would take 100 years to complete this, and many of them knew that what they were working at the beginning, that there's no way they would ever see the finished product, the end of the cathedral, and yet there was no evidence that it affected the quality of their work in any way. And what Phil Foege says is, much like that, in public health, we are building cathedrals for the future. We may not see that return on investment within the 10 or 20 year window, but if we're investing wisely and we know that, then we're building for the future. And so you are part of that building for the future, and I hope that provides a little bit of inspiration to keep doing the work you do. Thank you.